Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, June 3rd, 2010. Going right into the show, a lot of discussion tonight about comets. Some very strange topics dealing with comets. Some very big comets circling galaxies. So this in the news this week. And then the main science topics I will announce, first of all, and this is something I've been working on, my solution to the oil spill. Not a political solution, this is a physical solution, the way to seal this, and it's become apparent that they're not going to seal this oil. There's too much pressure, I'll do a little explanation of that, there's too much pressure, too much momentum in that tube. It would be like trying to stop a runaway train 5.5 miles long. This oil is really moving, so there's a lot of momentum, there's a lot of pressure behind it. They're probably not going to cap this and just shut it off. So it has to be driven to the top and basically used. But herein lies the problem. If you were to do this, and I'm sure British Petroleum knows this very well, you'd have to have a tanker there every very frequently. Let's just put it that way. All of a sudden, people would realize that there's a ton of oil down there, and it's coming out very fast, and it's amazing how mum and quiet the people in the Mideast are on this topic. They have not said a single thing, and I think the idea is that they cap these oil wells and let them trickle up to the surface so that they can sell it to you for an enormous price. But if you knew that the amount of oil that could be delivered from one of these major oil wells, then we would soon learn that we're being tremendously ripped off by this oil industry that's controlling volume, therefore pricing. Okay, but anyway, my solution will be forthcoming on how to contain and harvest, basically, this oil. Secondly, I'll do a review of closely visited comets and small moons in the solar system. Some very interesting review material going back to actually around 1986, when scientists first had unmanned spacecraft visiting Halley's Comet. There were actually four visited comets, so I'll talk about those. First, a couple quick announcements. The people in the Gulf are becoming sick. There are fishermen out there trying to do work for free, and I can't believe this. British Petroleum, is the executives of that corporation should be just taken to an international prison and put there and the key thrown away. These people are criminal. I understand now many other things. They were also responsible or lacked responsibility in cleaning up the Valdez, the Exxon Valdez spill. Apparently they had the contract to clean that up and never did. So there's these people have a long history of this type of activity. This is not new to them, but this oil spill has to be capped because the gases coming out of there are basically volcanic in nature. You know, when you're around a volcanic vent and there are gases coming out of the ground, you cannot breathe those gases. They are highly poisonous. People are getting sick, and the death toll will start to manifest itself soon. That's all I can tell you. Because people are going to become sick and they're going to start dying from breathing the air as a result of the poisonous gases coming out of this oil spill. So at any rate, I'll comment more on that. First, a couple quick announcements. Once again, my friend John Moore has a show just before mine on the same frequency and the hour before at 5 o'clock Central Time, so give a listen to John. He has a very different perspective than I do on many of the same topics, so listen to John, see what he has to say. I've been a guest on his show many, many, many times, but at any rate, just a heads up as to who's on this frequency on WWCR just prior to my show. My annual hurricane prediction was last week, so if you missed that show, go back and listen to it. The what day would that have been? May, was it 27th? Whatever that date, I believe that's what it was. My annual hurricane prediction, and just in summary, The result was that there was really not going to be any hurricane season at all. There were no significant electrical alignments. Of course, that could change if a big comet came into the solar system and started affecting the sun or creating new electrical alignments that weren't there before. But given things as they are right now, this hurricane season should be a dud, a zero. And then you have NOAA coming out and predicting, and some private agencies who work closely with NOAA, making prediction of this enormous, almost unheard of hurricane season. And of course, I think they do that to keep their funding flowing. If they came out every year and said, well, we don't think there's going to be many hurricanes, gee, do you think Congress would be real hot on funding them this coming year? No, they got to make a big splash, big scare tactic so they get their funding. It's the way it works in government science. Science is not the issue. Funding is the issue. So just keep that in mind. Whenever you see anything that comes out of government science, look first to the funding, and you'll probably find out what's causing people to say what they are saying. There was an announcement this week. There is a electric dust that is coming out of the Iceland volcanoes, and thus it should be, because it's in a very electrically active region. As the dust is blown out of the volcano, this column of material connects electrically with the ionosphere, much the same process as powers hurricanes. And so it is of no surprise that the dust coming out of there should be electrical in nature and electrically charged, so giving it very different properties as it floats in the atmosphere. And then many, many things electrical in the atmosphere. Well, one example is snowflakes. A snowflake is a ice crystal, very beautiful ice crystal, symmetric, usually six-way symmetric, symmetrical. And the people have tried to grow ice crystals in the laboratory, and they were not successful until they added an electric field. So it turns out that snowflakes that form high in the atmosphere require an electric field to form. Very interesting, and millions and gazillions of them form every year. Supposedly no two of them alike, but be that as it may, they need electric fields to produce. And so that also corresponds with my work dealing with the electrical nature of the solar system, which drives our vertical electric field, which drives storms, which allows snowflakes to form, and which allows electric dust to form as it comes out of volcanic calderas, as is the case with Iceland, the Icelandic volcanoes that are currently giving problems to the people in Europe, Ireland, England, etc. Some very large radio shows these days are posting what I consider imposters. Some call themselves researchers. And I just would like to know that this is a brand new term to me. I mean, I've got an advanced degree in physics. I've went to grad school. I went through the university system. I've taught in many university systems. And I've yet to see any place where somebody gets any kind of recognition as a researcher. So I'm trying to figure out exactly what a researcher is. Or a theorist. Now, what's a theorist? A theorist is somebody who sits in grandma's basement and theorizes? Apparently, what happened, I think, in a lot of these cases is people were trying to pretend like they had degrees of some time, and when they were called on it and it was shown that they had no degrees, they had to come up with another word. So researcher sounds kind of official, but, anybody could do research. A monkey sitting in a cage could do research, I guess. But at any rate, a lot of these people being put on major radio shows sometimes, doing bad, cheap imitations of my work sometimes. And, so unfortunately, the public has to sort this out. So anytime you hear somebody call themselves a researcher or a theorist, a big red flag pops up. So, on to the next topic. This came in from a listener, and it's always wonderful to hear from listeners. They many times have great commentary, great ideas. This listener said that warm seawater, warm salt water, has twice the conductivity as cold seawater. And that's a very interesting property because, as you know, in my theoretical work, the electrical, vertical electric field and vertical electric currents are the power sources that power hurricanes and cyclonic storms like tornadoes. Many times tornadoes are part of hurricanes. You'll see hurricanes as they come ashore with many tornadoes, and that's because the electrical shorting that occurs on the leading edge of the hurricane. But at any rate, this is interesting because as hurricanes approach land, they lose energy. And so what happens is that as they are out over the ocean, over cooler water, they really don't have a good conductivity. They don't have any, there's no place really for that electrical current to go. So it ionizes the air at the surface of the ocean, and that swoops in and then rushes up a central column. That's what we call the eye of the hurricane. But as this storm then moves ashore and starts to encounter shallow, warm seawater, conductivity increases and starts to short the storm out. Also can cause the storm to change direction. So, for example, the eastern coast of Florida is the most lightning-prone place on Earth. And many times in the evening or nighttime, I've flown down the central Florida, coming from somewhere in the heartland of the U.S., and any time of year, you can see the clouds forming out there and the lightning just constant, all up and down the eastern coast of Florida. The most lightning-prone place on Earth. Well, gee, what do you have there? You have a continental shelf with shallow, warm water. You don't really have this in many other places on Earth to that extent, and then it runs north and south. So all of that electrical activity that's coming in off of the Atlantic Ocean, where does it go? Florida. Warm water, shelf, a long continental shelf there leading it into land, and as the storms hit, the electricity dumps right there. Another interesting point, along that same line, Russian explorers used to claim and used to state that the auroras used to line along the coastline, so they would be in their ships or exploratory travels along the coastlines. Usually that's where people traveled back in the old days because there were no roads, there were no overland passages, so they would travel by ship close to shore. And they noticed that the auroras followed the coastlines, so it would be very easy to see that from the vantage point of a ship. So that was noticed a long time ago. So very much in line with this idea that the warmer water, of course, being close to the shore, and therefore that's where the electricity tends to move to flow down to the surface of the Earth. Just a quick mention, this past week, somebody was watching the History Channel and said, hey, you should watch this. So I stopped. There was a show on called Journey to 10,000 BC. Had a number of scientists. They belonged to various universities. And lo and behold, they were just about repeating Velikovsky line for line. They were stating that, gee, a large comet came in and had something to do with the demise of the mastodons, with the woolly mammoths, and the shrinking of the human population that occurred, and of course they put the date way back there, about 13,000 BC. And they were talking about Clovis points, and I think they were mixing many civilizations there. So I think these guys are at least starting to get on the right track, but number one, they totally fail to acknowledge the work of Velikovsky. Number two, they're missing a lot of the science. For example, the mastodons they showed in an animation falling to the ground as this big explosion occurred. Well, also, there's no crater for this amazingly big comet that struck Earth supposedly only 13,000 years ago. So they go, oh, it must have hit in an ice shelf someplace, and that's why we don't see it. Well, you know, you can take the Iceland, all of the ice cores have been drilled extensively, and there's no evidence of any big impact in any of them. But anyway, this is just more fairy tale science, but it allows them to, and standard science, to steal Velikovsky's work and try and make it a standard, you know. And of course, then they claim this is a very controversial theory, but it allows mainstream science to begin to peck away at Velikovsky's core issues, that somehow a comet was responsible for that catastrophe. And of course, as I said, they put it back 13,000 years, while Velikovsky puts it about 4,500 years ago, about 3,500 BC. And of course, not many people can accept that who are in the standard world of science or geology, whatever. But be that as it may, I just thought I would comment on that. And it just amazes me, the History Channel, Discovery Channel, National Geographic specials, all just cater, drooling over the bad science that's put out. And ultimately, it comes back to astronomy. Bad astronomy. Bad, incredibly bad astronomical theory. And there's some new spacecraft that are being built. They're going to be sent out, and data will be collected. Well, that's all wonderful, but ultimately, whether it's a new big telescope, whether it's a satellite that's going to go out, whether it's astronauts collecting data in the space shuttle or in outer space, whatever it is, ultimately that information comes back and is interpreted by the bad science being propagated from NASA and the scientific community today. It's just, fairy tale science, things that could not possibly be true. So at any rate, for example, just a quick example, the mastodons died standing up. They died standing up. They didn't fall over, because as soon as a big animal like that falls over, it takes a short time for them to decompose, because they're the warmth of the animal. And if anybody doubts this, I suggest you come up to Minnesota. I have this in one of my books. There's people who say, oh, that could last months and months. No. If you come up to Minnesota or any of the states have a deer population, and if that animal is out there one day, only one day, that meat is already rancid. And so these big animals were flash frozen, standing up, and the meat was so fresh when it was found thousands of years later that the Russian Siberian railway workers used to eat this, and that became so popular they sent it back to France as a delicacy. This meat was flash frozen. And I'll just make mention of this. I went to a buffalo ranch one time. And the buffalo is a big animal, but it does not compare in size to a mastodon. A mastodon is a much bigger animal. But at any rate, I went to a butcher and talked to... Back on the air. We had a little connectivity difficulty here, but we're back on the air now. Sorry about that, a little technical difficulty. But at any rate, the mastodons, I was saying, were died standing up. And that's the way they were found. The meat was flash frozen. So anyway, I asked this butcher in the buffalo farm, I said, what would it take to flash freeze a buffalo, a live buffalo, if you could walk one into your freezer and crank the temperature down as low as you could in your big freezer where you keep all of the buffalo meat here. I said, how long would it take you to freeze that buffalo? He said, well, if it were alive? And I said, yeah, if it was alive. And at first he said if it was dead, it would take, you know, a long time, because, of course, they only freeze cut up butchered pieces of buffalo there. But he said it would take days, if not weeks, to flash freeze a buffalo. And I said, well, what if it was alive? And he laughed at me. He said, you can't freeze a buffalo. They stand out there at 40 below. And they're just fine. They're made to take that. And so the mastodons were a big animal, much bigger than a buffalo. And so I said, well, how about something like a mastodon? And he just looked at me like I was crazy. You know, here's a guy with experience in freezing meat. And so anyway, I just get a kick out of these scientists that are just, they're just so clueless. I've never met people that are just so clueless. So anyway, they have this fairy tale science that the mastodons were somehow killed by this big blast, a comet hit Earth. And of course, the comet never hit Earth, it came by. Action at a distance. So the point is that they have all of their science wrong when it comes to the astronomical part. They're starting to get some facts and figures straight. The mastodons did die at one time. It was pretty tough on the human race. They got the age wrong. They got a lot of things wrong. But they're starting to inch what I call the creeping crud towards this idea of stealing Velikovsky's work. And of course, they never reference Velikovsky, but they can put a big, very well animated special on the History Channel, and everybody's supposed to watch it and believe it. But I just want to make a comment on this, that the scientists are starting to steal wholesale Velikovsky's work, mix it with tremendously bad astronomical science, and come up with garbage that they put on for your consumption on the History Channel. As I said, the History Channel, Discovery Channel, National Geographic are all prime locations for garbage science, fairy tale science, as I call it. Okay, on to the next topic. Let me see if I've covered all of the... I believe so, as far as the... So the other point about the mastodon issue is that there had to be a pole shift. The mastodon was a tropical animal, a semi-tropical animal. And so they were eating plants, semi-tropical plants, and these were flash frozen. The plants were undigested with the acid that would have been in their throats. So these were flash frozen in an instant, an animal that size, alive, standing on its feet. And I just got a kick out of seeing a picture on the cover of Discovery magazine a number of years ago. They were digging one of these out of the tundra up in Siberia, one of these huge animals, and they had to bring in an American helicopter because this thing weighed so much, it was frozen. So they had cut it out, and they had dug it out, and it's like 10 feet deep in the Siberian tundra, standing on all 4 feet, dead, frozen to death, standing there. So let's go back to the butcher. Let's see what it would take to flash freeze that mastodon with the tropical plants in its throat, and then you find it almost on the Arctic Circle in Siberia. Gee, Mr. Standard Scientist, what might that tell you? We had a pole shift. A pole shift about 30 to 45 degrees. The Laurentian ice cap never was in Siberia. How did we have an ice cap that was a major ice cap on the North American continent and nothing corresponding in Siberia? None of this makes any sense at all. The standard science is so retarded, and that yet they teach this as if it were some kind of truth. Okay, on to the next topic. Excuse me for ranting and raving, but it's enough to drive you crazy to see these scientists just sit there and repeat this like a nursery rhyme, and I guess to them it probably is, but it's good for a paycheck. This is an interesting story about comets. Monster comets, it says, found orbiting a black hole, and they're talking about the galactic nucleus of a galaxy. They're showing a picture here, and scientists have seen large comets orbiting very fast around the central part of galaxies, and they're starting to see more of these. So at any rate, actually, this confirms much of my work that was done early when I talked about galaxies. I said, you're going to find these cometary-type objects, the discharge of the capacitor, because the galaxy has a fusion core, and it's setting out excess current of protons, just like our sun. So you're going to find these cometary activities around a galactic nucleus, and of course they did. There's no ice there, boys and girls, but it's amazing they see these cometary structures, and they have to call them comets because they are comets. They look like comets. But where is the dirty snowball at the center of the galaxy? Of course, it doesn't make any sense. But be that as it may, once again, data, newly discovered data, which just doesn't match the fairy tale science that's being passed off to you, the public. Okay, last week I was going to, the next science topic I'm going to deal with is how to fix the oil spill in the Gulf. And this has to be done. People are going to start dying due to this. This is just not the most environmentally disastrous thing that's ever happened to our planet. This is an absolute disaster, but the gases that are coming out, they're not talking about. When you see an oil well, in an oil derrick or whatever, there's always a flame up at the top. Those are the gases that are coming out. These oil deposits are deep in the earth, and just like a volcanic vent, they are venting out some incredibly toxic gases, not just hydrocarbons, but other types of very, very poisonous gases. If you ever go around a volcanic vent, there would be signs all over the place, do not breathe the air. You cannot breathe this air because it's highly poisonous. People are getting sick. These poor fishermen are out there trying to help because it is trying to save their livelihood. This impossible battle against this oil spill that continues, and now they're saying they can't cap it off until late fall. This is criminal. This is absolutely criminal against the world population and especially the population of the Gulf area, but to all of us, because the summer rains are going to start bringing in the air from the Gulf, and it's going to start raining into the plants throughout the crops throughout the central United States. Your garden is going to be polluted with chemicals that are coming from this bad air down there. People are going to, they're already being admitted to hospitals. The one I saw on CNN, this one poor fisherman's wife was there saying, we're all getting sick from this. And what we're out there trying to work is because they're trying to save their business. This is criminal. And BP Oil is just sitting back and basically, well, as far as I can tell, doing nothing. And that's the same thing they did that caused this entire thing. They didn't take precautions. But what can be done? This has to be cured, and it's not going to be done by our government. Obama is showing his worthless colors, and if George Bush were in there, he would be equally worthless. None of these people, Clinton, none of these people would be worth anything because they don't know anything. We have presidents and world leaders that really don't know anything. All they can do is get up and give some kind of stupid speech. Like, oh, we're really going to do this. Or BP Oil CEO executive on, I saw him, he says, now we're going to work double time. What were they doing before? Working half time? Where do these people come from? I cannot believe that these people get away with this. They should all be dragged off and put in prison. At any rate, the solution is as follows, and you heard it here. I used to live in New Orleans. I lived there. I went to Tulane University for 2 years. I rode my bicycles on the levees. And New Orleans is a big shipbuilding area, a lot of big shipbuilding industry there. So they have the capacity. So here's my solution. You build a funnel. We're all familiar with the metal funnels or a plastic funnel. You buy them at the store. You use it to pour oil in your car or use it in the kitchen for food processing or whatever. A funnel. It's a tapered cone, and then it has a smaller, narrower tapered cone at the bottom. And we use it to pour things and concentrate liquids or solids, whatever, into a container. Okay, now turn the funnel upside down with the big part down and the little part up. If you make a big enough one, and they could easily do this in New Orleans in the shipbuilding industry down there, build a funnel 100 feet in diameter, 150 feet in diameter, would not be that big a thing for them to do this. Out of steel, just shipbuilding steel, nothing fancy, and take it out there and drop it down over the vents. Make the funnel big enough to cover all the open vents. Okay, now what's going to happen? Gee, now that oil is going to come out the top of the funnel. All it would take is the equivalent of a sewer tube a mile long. We have sewage tubes that run for tens, hundreds of miles sometimes, or rubber tubing or whatever type of tubing you would choose, and take it down and just put it on top of the funnel, and up that the oil will force itself up through the tube. Very simple. And the water pressure down there will assist, but there's a lot of pressure coming up out of that vent with the oil behind it. Sooner or later, all the water in your funnel will be evacuated. It'll come up the tube, and you simply bring a ocean tanker, oil tanker alongside, and you pump it into the oil tanker. You just let it spill into the oil tanker. But you know what we figured out is that this would start to fill up the oil tanker so fast that, gee, all of a sudden people would realize, look at all this oil that's coming out of here. We don't need oil from the Mideast. We don't need oil from all these hundreds of oil derricks out in the Gulf. We only need a couple of these major oil self-primed or high-pressure oil reservoirs to provide a great deal of our oil. Of course, that's what British Petroleum does not want you to know. The amount and the volume of available oil. This thing would probably flow for 10 years. You'd have to have the oil tankers lined up, ready to come alongside of this thing as they're being filled up and coming into land. It would absolutely ruin the oil industry overnight. So, gee, I wonder why BP Oil does not want to cap that thing off or to make use of that oil. By the way, I was going to announce this last week's show. Last Thursday, May 27th, this was a headline in the Miami Herald, I believe. Maybe it was a few days earlier. Anyway, British Petroleum has requested that a special judge be appointed for all the lawsuits. I guess there's thousands of them already pending. And it just shows you how the U.S. court system is owned. But BP, British Petroleum, wants the lawsuits to be all heard by a special judge, and they even named this person to hear all the cases. Gee, he's from Houston, has serious ties to the oil industry, and that's who they want, special appointed judge to hear all the lawsuits that come against them. These people just have no conscience at all. As I said, one-way ticket to prison. Put all the executives in there and tell this is solved. Gee, I bet something might get done at that point. But know that these people, it's very clear. I've heard also that Goldman Sachs shorted and sold off a lot of British Petroleum stock just days before this happened. This looks like another 9-1-1. It looks like another Oklahoma City bombing. It looks like another Katrina. It looks like a planned environmental disaster. And so it doesn't look like they want to cap this. The people of the world, and especially this country, which is responsible for that area, have to go out, and this has to be a private effort, and you just take these people and throw them out of there. Get out of there, don't come back. This is, you know, the fact that the government, the U.S. government, is basically doing nothing. But the bottom line is, the people of this country cannot wait for the government of the U.S. or Obama. These people are all worthless. They don't know anything. They don't know how to do anything. And if they did, they're all controlled. So this has got to be done by a private effort. The solution I'm giving will work. The other thing you could do with the funnel is to build some cages on it. And so you could put rock or steel weights in there to hold that funnel down so it's a good seal against the bottom. I'm sure the bottom there is nice and flat, sand bottom, you know, the area of the Gulf where this oil leak is occurring. And they're never going to cap this because of the amount of momentum of the oil rushing up that tube. Remember, that tube goes down 18,000 feet. That's like 5.5 miles of tubing. And the oil is coming up under very high pressure at a very high velocity. So I don't think they're ever going to cap this thing. Capping it and all the stupid things they try to do, try to pour a little mud down there. What kind of moron ever imagined that they were going to stop that by pouring a little bit of mud down the hole? Just amazing to me. They must have got NASA to work on that one. So at any rate, this has to be solved. Government, BP, and all of the organizations related to this are not going to do anything. This has to be a private effort, and it has to be done. People are going to get sick. It's already an environmental disaster of earthwide proportions. And so this has to be done. It has to be done through private hands. And without any, it's not a question of asking permission. This has to be done, period. On to the next topic. I'm going to do some review of comets. And these are comets that we have visited with unmanned space probes, actually four of them now. Comet Halley's in 1986, Comet Borrelly in 2001, Comet Vilde 2 in 2004, and then Comet Temple 1 with a deep impact July 4, 2005. So there's four comets that we have visited. And oddly enough, Comet Borrelly had a very black, charry surface on its surface. One of the blackest, and I believe to date still the blackest object ever seen in the solar system. So it was covered with a hot, charry substance that would indicate oil. And so part of the point of this comet review is to indicate that comets and other moons, small solar system objects around the solar system, including our own moon, would be ripe candidates for oil, hydrocarbons, because that's part of the cometary process. And so right on the surface of one, Comet Borrelly, you see the evidence of that. Here's another fan input, that Iapetus, that's one of the moons of Saturn, has a very black side to it. And when you look at it, it looks like somebody took some oil and splattered it all over that black side. And it's very, very clear that there's some material there, probably very likely oil. There's evidence that when one of the impactors was sent into our very own moon, that it did not hit dust and create a big dust cloud. What it hit was oil. Hydrocarbons, and NASA once again very mum about that. If oil is a fossil fuel created from the, once again, fairy tale science, fossil fuel, what a term, implying that all this oil came from dinosaur bones or something. What a ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous concept, but it's widely, the term is widely used, fossil fuels. This is not from fossils. Where were the fossils that created the deposit 18,000 feet under the surface of the ocean floor with this oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico? Where were the dinosaur bones that somehow got down there to create this oil? It's so absolutely ridiculous. Once again, ridiculous science, and we listen to this every day as if it were somehow true. Literally every major concept that comes out of standard science today is wrong. Absolutely wrong, couldn't possibly be true, but they continue talking about it as if it were gospel truth. And it's amazing, that's why Americans are probably some of the dumbest people on the planet. They have a lot of knowledge, but it's all bad knowledge. It's bad information. If you know a lot of information that's incorrect, are you intelligent? I don't think so. So at any rate, let's go back to 1986 Comet Halley. There was a French spacecraft called Giotto, which had cameras on it, and it gave the first pictures of the nucleus of a comet. And so I have a little story. I believe it's in the Atlantis to Tesla book. It's called Fluff, Fluffier, and Fluffiest, and it's a little three-act play that I put together based on the encounter of the Giotto spacecraft, but basically it amounts to the following. They expected to see a white, snowy snowball that was the core of the comet Halley, and they knew it was about 7 miles long. They had radio indications before that suggested about how big it was, but they had never seen a comet nucleus up close. So anyway, as the Giotto spacecraft is tunneling its way through the coma, that's the dust and gas cloud that surrounds the comet, as it's tunneling its way through, it's starting to get closer and closer, and the nucleus is starting to take shape, a big potato-shaped nucleus. And it's becoming brighter and whiter and whiter and whiter, and all of a sudden, everybody screams out, "That's it! That's the nucleus! That's the nucleus!" And then the Giotto spacecraft breaks through the final dust layers to reveal what turned out to be the blackest object to date ever seen in the solar system. And this is another example of simply bad science. And of course, when I predicted what a comet nucleus would look like, that's exactly what I said. That it's just a dry, rocky object, a hot, dry, rocky object. And it would make sense also with the electron beam coming in from the sunward side, if there were hydrocarbons, that they would be burned onto that comet nucleus, which was then discovered in 2001 with a flyby of Comet Borley. And of course, once again, surprising comet scientists, these standard people who have gained paychecks over the decades for basically distributing bad science. They're completely wrong. So the point is that comets, and the tails of comets, there are many chemicals that form. They're drawn into the comet nucleus, and in the cometary phase, the planets, the moons, all of these objects we see in the solar system at one time were cometary objects captured into the solar system by Jupiter and eventually became planets, moons, asteroids, etc. All of this material came at a later date from the original formation of the Sun and Jupiter, which Jupiter is the companion star, very simply. It has the same axis of rotation as the Sun, points in the same direction. It spins all of the characteristics, the composition of the atmosphere, all very much the same as the Sun. So it's very easy to see that Jupiter and the Sun were the original twin star of the solar system, and they captured all of these other celestial objects. So the comets then, the planets or the moons, when they were in the comet stage, had the ability to pull in hydrocarbons. And of course, in a very energetic comet, you get much bigger molecules. So therefore, the crude oil, the very heavy crude oils, all of the various hydrocarbon chains are formed. So everything from benzene and the very light hydrocarbon forms, and also the hydrogen compounds, all of these forming in the comet tail, oxygen and hydrogen making water, all of these forming. And of course, that's one of the reasons why we see water on Earth that is very different than water you find in outer space. Water that you find free in outer space typically has deuterium in it, not hydrogen. So, but you can see in the comet tail, the water in comet tails, you see H2O, water, like we have on Earth. But when you get to the comet nucleus, let me tell you something. Of Halley's Comet, Borley, Vild 2, and Tempel 1, the four cometary nuclei that were visited by spacecraft, not a single one exhibited ice or snow or any other remnant of water. And so you can say, well, how can that possibly be? Well, the point is that the water and the chemicals that you see are being formed in the tail and drawn into the comet nucleus, where they really don't last long. These were small comets. They don't really last. They don't have the gravitational attraction to keep this material. As in the case of Borley, the hydrocarbons were burned onto it, and so therefore it's not held by gravity, but more of a viscous or a like a tar-like adhesion to the comet nucleus. So a very interesting situation there with Comet Borley. Comet Vild 2 looks more like a hot, dry rock. Once again, no water. And Comet Tempel 1, they had an impactor called Deep Impact, Deep Impact Probe that went into the comet nucleus. And scientists were expecting to see water gushing out from the interior of the comet. Well, what did they find? No, they didn't find water. There's all kinds of false claims coming out of NASA that claim they did see water, but those were from remote viewing from Earth-based telescopes. And they seemed to think that maybe there was a correlation between a little increase in water activity in the comet tail at the time when the impactor hit. But the reality is the direct observation of the impactor, first of all, there was a flash, an electrical discharge, which is very understandable and very predictable. It's something I talked about in many of my radio shows long before the deep impact probe hit. And also that night, July 4th, 2005, I happened to be a special guest on the Coast to Coast radio show with George Norrie, where basically he announced to the world that James McCanney plasma discharge comet model was correct and verified by the deep impactor. But of course, there was almost silence that came out of NASA, and weeks afterwards, they refused to release the data from that July 4th, 2005 impact. Finally, the data came out and was all doctored and smoothed over. As I said, they were trying to state that they saw some water production from Earth from a remote telescope, but all the data taken locally was very simply not, there was no water there. In fact, the surface, they had cameras that took a lot of detailed information off the surface of Comet Tempel 1. And I forget what it was, like 0.004% of the surface had any trace of water at all. And the point is that on all four of these, Comet Halley, Borley, Vild 2, and Tempel 1, you did not see this nice, even flow of material that would have to occur if the water in the tail region were coming from the comet nucleus. None of the things that they predicted came to pass. None of them were true. They saw jets coming off the comet nucleus, but these very questionable, what in many cases this was dust and gas, probably from electrical discharge activity levitating off the nucleus or being blasted off by electrical discharges that occurred locally. But the point is that this is not what is needed to create the water, that nice, even water coma that you see around the comet nucleus. If you read my early papers, you'll understand that that nice, even flow of water material or hydrocarbons or other chemicals, CO, CO2, that are in comet tails, the reason they have a nice flowing coma shape is because of electric fields. It's the characteristic shape of the electric field of the comet. When combined with the local electric field and then also the electric field that is seen through the plasma to the sun, all of these have to be understood and understand the why that tail points away from the sun. That's where the material is coming from to form the comet. And so basically, in review, what I'm trying to point out here is that comets are the source of hydrocarbons, and when Earth passes through the tail of a very large comet, which we happen to do in recorded history, when Venus came through the solar system, Earth actually took on a great deal of oil, and the ancients talk about it. It's the brimstone came, that was the rock, the rock that came in, burning rock that came in with what they called naphtha. And so this came in and actually pooled on the surface of the Earth. It was a tremendous pollution event with a lot of chemicals. The Earth was shaken. The volcanoes were erupting. Earth was under siege. And this is what Velikovsky talks about. So when you understand what Velikovsky was saying, he was simply interpreting the message passed down to us from the ancients. The message that Earth underwent a catastrophe. And that's the other thing. When the scientists on the History Channel who are trying to start to understand some of these issues, they leave out half of the issues. Very, very historic. The historical data is very clear that brimstone and naphtha came in from the upper atmosphere. There was a lot of activity that occurred outside the atmosphere, and it was very clear that it was due to a large comet. But all of this has been erased out of the history books. That's why there's so much effort to destroy the Colburn That's why there's so much effort to destroy anything of history. That's why there's so much effort to try and call Velikovsky a crackpot, because they can then take that material and twist it and distort it to meet their own goal, which is to provide bad science to the public. And the equation here, the equation that is needed, is that the scientists have to work for money. That's why Obama increased the budgets of these federal agencies. That's the one way to keep the ring into the nose of all these scientists, because they work for money, very simply, and they have to stay within certain boundaries, and they all have to come back and agree with this incredibly impossible view of the solar system, of the workings of the cosmos, of the astronomical theories that are simply fairy tale science, could not possibly be true. So at any rate, Comet Vild 2 was very interesting in that it was a hot, dry rock. This is in 2004, and very pitted. And so what would cause pitting on a small object like that? Clearly, these were electrical discharge pits that occurred when this comet was very active. Comet Tempel 1 also had the amazing features of the type of, let's call them cliff systems that you would find on Earth. Cliff systems, rock structures, amazing contours that you would only find on, for example, a planet like Earth that had an atmosphere. So where did this piece of rock come from? Was it part of a distant solar system that where there was a massive collision? The space is filled with these rocks. We don't know where they came from. Did they come from our own solar system? Could there have been a planet here that underwent a tremendous collision long in the distant past, and something came in and with a direct hit? Very, very much a possibility. So at any rate, the point, though, is that if you look at the small moons of the solar system, if you start to excavate many of these, I'm sure you're going to find oil, hydrocarbons, just like you find on Earth. If we have it on Earth, you're going to find it on these other planets. Venus is a little bit different in that it is still extremely hot. So many of the chemicals in the Venusian atmosphere are still in a very different form, in terms of chemicals that can exist in that extremely hot atmosphere. So Venus is a prime example of a planet, a newly formed planet, just a number of thousands of years old. It was brought into the solar system by capture. The tail drag, which occurs during the discharge of the solar capacitor, the tail drag is what allows it to circle, spiral into its orbit, where it finally became the second planet in our solar system. And eventually the comet tail went away, and that's verified, for example, in many different places historically. But in the Mayan theology dealing with Quetzalcoatl, where the Quetzalcoatl was the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus. Very clear. There again, modern archaeologists refuse to understand these facts, or the fact that Quetzalcoatl was associated with Venus for a reason, because Venus was a comet. Venus was a huge comet. It lost its tail within historical times. I imagine that it probably took 600 years, that it took about 600 years for Venus to finally settle into the orbit we see today. So that would have been from, according to Velikovsky's time frame, about 3500 BC, so around to 2900 BC. Venus would have had a tail, would have been a large comet throughout that historical period, and then eventually losing its tail. And these were the people who handed the information down, probably the number and the lettering system and the theologies, that eventually ended up with the Mayans that we call the Mayans today, the Mayans that existed around 800 AD, but very definitely carried all of that information forward for thousands of years because it was important in their society to inform future generations that these major earth-shattering events can occur. So that's interesting. That's an interesting point to see that other cultures very much put it as part of their civilization, their central religion, if you want to call it that, or mythology, whatever you want to call it. They made a very clear point of stressing the fact that their pyramids, their cities were based on this, that their entire life was based on the idea, and large religious ceremonies, etc., were based on the idea that Venus was a large comet, Quetzalcoatl, etc., etc. So I'm just going to take the last minute or so here, because I have to cut out at 58 minutes afterwards because of the frequency change in WWCR. They go to the nighttime frequency. So I just want to mention that everybody, I think, out there needs a water filter and also a case of flax per person. That's minimum, in my estimation, what you need to survive in the world today. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. That's J-M-C as in cat, C as in cat, S as in Sam, C as in cat, I as in indigo.com. Or also mail order, JMCC P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. Once again, mail order address JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. And your purchases, besides helping you, help you listen to this commercial-free show. So for $289, I recommend you get the Dalton water filter. That comes with the four water filter elements. It comes with a free Kato WX911 radio and free shipping to the 50 states. And also a case of flax per person for your loved ones, $130, plus typically about $40 shipping. There's I charge shipping for the flax, free water shipping on the water filter. And I'm just about out of time here, so join me next week as I once again visit the cosmos and bring it into your living room. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.